Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Laura Lee. Michael Cremo joins us for an update. He helps us rethink our history by following where the evidence leads. And he and Richard Thompson's book, Forbidden Archaeology, made a huge splash some years ago. Very important reading. Michael's back to tell us a bit about the Chumai discovery. Yet another set of bones were found, alleged to be an early human ancestor. Michael says, looks like just another ape to him. And Michael, always good to get the other point of view here. How are you and welcome back?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm just back from a trip to Europe. I'm in Los Angeles now. And actually, it was in Europe that this story broke, and many people were coming up to me asking me, well, what's my opinion about it?
Tell us about the discovery first.
Well, the discovery was made by a student from Chad who was working with a French researcher, Michel Brunet, in Chad, which is a country in Central Africa. It's in the sub-Saharan region, so a lot of it's desert now. And it's a place that's quite far from where most of the hominid discoveries have been made, the ones that we're familiar with, like Lucy and all the other Australopithecines. Most of those discoveries were made in East Africa in an area that's called the Rift Valley, you know, that runs down through Ethiopia and Tanzania and Kenya. That's where the Leakeys have always worked, for example.
And it's nice for archaeologists to find an area where some of this very ancient strata is exposed so they can get to it, right?
Right. So in Chad, there were some areas of ancient strata that were exposed. They're believed to be between 6 and 7 million years old, and Brunet thought that that's where he might find some hominid fossils that could be instrumental in straightening out the current evolutionary picture of, you know, human origins, because most scientists today think that the hominids, those would be the ape men who eventually became humans, according to their theories, they think they would have split off from the ancestors of the modern apes, like the gorilla and the chimpanzee, about 7 million years ago. So a lot of archaeologists have been looking in strata of those ages to try to find this creature. So Brunet and his student thought, yes, we've got it. And the discovery has been presented in such a way as to suggest it's absolutely certain that this is a human ancestor. You gave the name Toumai, which is a popular name that was given.
T-O-U-M-A-I, if anyone wants to look it up.
Yeah, and that means the hoped-for one or something. It comes from the local language there, the hope of
life.
Yeah, the hope of life. But the official scientific name that they gave to it was Sahelanthropus chadensis. So chadensis means it comes from Chad, from that country. Sahel means the sub-Saharan region of Africa, that arid region just to the south of the Sahara Desert. And anthropus means man, human being. That's where we get the word anthropology, you know, the study of humanity. So they called it Sahelanthropus. Now, to call it man, I believe, is quite a stretch. If you actually look at this creature, it has eyebrow ridges that go straight across. It's not even two eyebrow ridges. It's a single massive bar of bone that goes over both eye sockets, just like a big visor sticking out.
The unibrow.
Yes, like that. It's quite extraordinary. It's not at all human in any way. Although scientists, because they believe they have absolute faith, many of them, that we did come from more ape-like ancestors, they tend to see human-like features in these very ape-like bones. It's just as if, you know, somebody were looking in the sky. Of course you can see some human-like features of clouds even in the sky.
There's,
you know,
a nose, there's two eyes.
There's a, yeah, it looks human. But whether that actually has anything to do with human ancestry and these very ape-like bones, I'd have to say probably not. And there are a few reasons for that. Of course, those who are familiar with my work in forbidden archaeology know that I am particularly focused on showing evidence for extreme human antiquity, evidence showing that humans like us have existed 7 million years ago, 70 million years ago, even 700 million years ago. So when this anomalous evidence is taken into account, you know, the human skeletal remains that are absolutely anatomically modern, but which go back much further in time than even this new discovery, the Tumai or Sahelanthropus discovery in Chad, then we begin to wonder, what's all the fuss really about?
Before we get to what the fuss is about, according to your suspicions, I want to mention that Bridget Sennett, who's with the National History of Museum in Paris, along with a number of other authorities, according to a press release that I read, agree that the skulls featured of this particular find are not linked to human ancestry, but instead resemble those of a female gorilla. So you have some other experts in the field who aren't intent on demonstrating that human antiquity is so old that would agree with you. When you just find a skull, and really the hallmark of a human as opposed to another ape is the upright walking position, is it not? How can you even start to assign human ancestry when you don't have a full skeleton, is my question.
Well, some will say that they can see, you know, signs in the skull, such as the placement of the...
Where the spine connects.
Where the spine connects, that, you know, but this is highly speculative, and you're absolutely right. Until they find the rest of the skeleton of the creature and have a chance to see how its arms and legs are structured, it's really very difficult to say that it walked upright like a modern
human. Well, a spine attaches, you know, right on the underside of our skull because it sits on top of it, and don't the spines attach kind of in the back of the neck to other apes? Their gait is different? Their stance is different?
There are some differences that some physical anthropologists have noted about, you know, the exact place where that foramen magnum, as it's called, the place where the spine attaches to the skull is placed. That could help possibly, you know, determine, you know, what the gait of the creature was. But I think in this case, the skull, that part of the skull, really isn't that complete here. And in any case,
you've got the
you would have to confirm it. You would really have to confirm it with the actual postcranial bones, the bones that belong to the creature below the neck, not just the ones above it.
But this brow ridge, and what about the nose and the cheeks and other features? Do they show any divergence towards a human face as opposed to a gorilla's face?
They would. The supporters will say that the face is relatively flat, you know, below the eyebrows, below the heavy eyebrows. They'll say it's flat, and they'll say that's a human characteristic. But as others have pointed out, that's also possibly a characteristic of the females of these various species. There's a lot of
The females would be more flat-faced than the males?
Yes. And
is that true of modern apes?
In gorillas and things like that. That's why Bridget Sennett, for example, was saying this could be just
a
creature resembling a female gorilla.
I see.
Because there's some it's called sexual dimorphism. Now, in humans, we don't see a lot of sexual dimorphism. Generally, men are somewhat bigger than the females of the species, and there are a few differences. But in the apes, you know, like the gorillas and other creatures, the non-human members of the family, the sexual dimorphism is much greater. And also, these can be features of juveniles as well.
Interesting.
Now, they think, they are calculating that this creature must have been an adult, but that's not 100% sure.
How big is it compared to a modern gorilla?
They say the skull size is just about the same as that of a modern chimpanzee. The brain capacity is about the same. So you have a creature about the size of a chimpanzee, probably one of the smaller members of the chimpanzee family.
Or a juvenile female, possibly.
A bigger creature.
Because if you don't have a whole range of age groups represented in one species, then how can you even start to compare that? It's hard to take a set of human bones and determine it's male or female or the age. We only know that because we've got a whole lot of bones to compare them with.
Right. So they haven't. Some researchers, like Bernard Woods here in the United States, say they really have to, if they want to call this creature a male, which would distinguish it from the female, they would have to find again the other bones from the creature, because it's those bones from the lower part of the body that are diagnostic, as they would say, that would let us tell what sex the creature actually was.
Now, tell us, because this all relates to the agenda here that you say is a hidden agenda and a knowledge filter, tell us about the other finds in the past couple of years that had the same kind of instant attribution to human ancestry and the same kind of publicity. Eureka, look what we found, and this completes the picture that we're trying to promote here. Ardipithecus, Millennium Man, and Flatface, or Kenyanthropus. Tell us just a bit about those finds.
Well, Millennium Man is very interesting because you mentioned Brigitte Sanoutz, you know, from France, who was criticizing this particular discovery. Of course, she's promoting her own discovery, you know, this Millennium Man, which was also discovered in Africa. So sometimes when scientists like her are criticizing the work of other scientists, it's because they have their own candidate for the father or mother of us all that they're trying to
promote.
And each one of these discoveries is promoted as a revolution in our understanding of human evolution. Sometimes people come up to me and they say, well, doesn't that support what you're saying? And I have to explain to them that, no, the real revolution would be if these people would understand that alongside these primitive apes and monkeys, humans like us were already existing. That would be a real revolution.
And you can say that because forbidden archaeology documents 100 artifacts and more that would support that line of thinking.
Oh, yes.
So
there's
as much evidence for that assumption as there is that we evolved directly from apes not too long ago.
Right.
Okay.
And now the one candidate for, you know, human ancestor has been this Millennium Man, which has been promoted by one of the discoverers, Brigitte Sanoutz. Now we have this Tumai, who has been advertised in Time magazine recently as, you know, perhaps being the father of us all.
Mother.
Or mother, it turns out. They say father, but that could be completely wrong.
She's a female, apparently.
Right. And then there was Kenyanthropus, which was discovered by Meave Leakey, who was the wife of Richard Leakey. In other words, she's one of the members of that famous Leakey clan. And it's very interesting that most scientists have proposed that the line of human origins comes from some unknown creature who existed around 6 or 7 million years ago and split off from the chimpanzee line. And that's what they're fighting about now. That's why this Chad discovery, this Toumai discovery, this Sahel Anthropus chadensis discovery is attracting a lot of attention because it's right in the period where scientists think that the human beings first ancestors split off from the chimpanzee line. And then they think, most of them have thought, the line of ancestry would go up to Australopithecus, to Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis, or one of her relatives. And then it would go from there to the Homo line, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, up to Homo sapiens. Now, Louis Leakey, kind of the founding father of the Leakey clan of archaeologists, he didn't believe that. It's not very well known, but he didn't think that Australopithecus or Homo erectus had anything to do with the modern human type. And one reason is, he pointed out, these creatures have these massive brow ridges that go straight across.
Whereas
we don't have that. You know, if you just look in the mirror, I mean, even if you have some heavy brow ridges, as some people do, there are usually two of them, and they kind of go in a circle above, you know, a semicircle above each eye socket. We don't even people that we see out in the street who may look to us to have very heavy brow ridges, they don't have a straight one that goes right across like a visor.
Some people's
right
eyebrows
across.
May grow together.
Yes.
That's a different issue. Go ahead.
Well, even the two eyebrows, they're generally curved.
And separate, yeah.
Yeah, it's separate. But the brow ridges, so for that reason, he thought, These creatures, you know, Australopithecus and Homo erectus, which have these heavy brow ridges, they couldn't possibly be human ancestors. That's a really quite a revolutionary idea that he had, not a very well-known one. But,
and why isn't it more well-known? And after all, aren't his opinions important here in the finds?
Yes. So his work was carried on by Mary Leakey, who made some interesting discoveries. She was the one who discovered these fantastic footprints that are about 4 million years old.
Oh, aren't those intriguing?
At Laetoli, which are completely human in form, completely human in form. And I would take them as evidence that humans like us were walking around, you know, 4 million years ago in Africa, right alongside these.
Because how do you make a footprint that looks modern and human if you don't have the rest of the skeletor to make that footprint?
That's right. Now, some people, including Mary Leakey, proposed, well, there must have been some kind of ape man who existed at that time in Africa who had feet exactly like ours, but they've never found the skeleton of such an ape man. All of the skeletons of ape men that they found belonging to this Australopithecus group have ape-like feet. When you look at the foot bones, you see they're not of human proportion at all.
And how could you have feet that developed so much before the rest of the skeletature?
Well,
in which case, if you have modern anatomical humans back 4 million years, then so they're just a separate line, just like we are today, separate from all the other hominids, right?
Yes. Well, all the other apes today scientists would say we're the only hominid that's existing, but they would say the hominoids.
Thank you,
thanks. I mean,
get my language right.
It's a technical point, but they'd say that today humans are the only hominids alive, but the hominoids, the apes and monkeys, yeah, we coexist with them, just as we did in the past.
And just like that other line of evidence that you feature so nicely in Forbidden Archaeology suggests has been going on for millions and millions of years.
But, yeah, it's interesting. Still, there's always been this, the Leakeys have always been in competition with others. Now, Mary Leakey herself, like her husband, she didn't believe that Australopithecus, Lucy, for example, was a human ancestor. And that opinion was shared by her son, Richard Leakey. Again, it's not that well known, but he also believed that. And then Neve Leakey, she was carrying on the family tradition when she announced the discovery about 2 years ago of Kenyanthropus, and she called it flat face. You have to have a name, a popular name, because nobody can remember all these scientific names.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of years ago, there was just as much fuss being made about this flat face as there is being made now about the discovery from Chad, Tumai. And again, it was announced, yes, this will shake up our whole picture of, you know, human evolution.
It's not really shaking anything up. It's just, according to the picture that's being painted, pushing it back a little further, is it not?
Yes, or I, you know, to me it's sort of like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, so to speak. I mean, it's a
same
change, but it's not, but the whole ship is going down, really. If you confront it, I would consider the, you know, the evidence documented in forbidden archaeology to be like the...
No, that's shaking
the iceberg. Yeah, the iceberg that's kind of put a hole in the whole Titanic theory of human evolution that's out there today. And they may keep rearranging a little bit, you know, the deck chairs. In other words, saying it may have been this hominid or that hominid that was the human ancestor. But basically, they all still accept the idea that there was some tiny little ape-like creature. And they may disagree about which tiny little ape-like creature it was, who was our original father or mother. But they think it was some type of small ape-like creature that eventually became bigger and bigger and
more
eventually
upright.
Became the human, and more upright with a bigger brain, that eventually became, you know, the humans that we see around us today.
How did they make you feel about their finds? Were they saying, well, we've been searching for that elusive common ancestor, but all we found were these ape bones? You know, is that how they feel?
Well, I think what the Neve Leakey, the most recent member of the family to announce the discovery.
She's promoting hers as that part of that missing link, but the other Leakeys?
Yes, well, she would say, yes, there was a line, because her discovery went back about 4 million years or so, 4 or 5 million years. And she wanted to say it was through this creature and not through Australopithecus and Homo erectus, you know, that the human line came. Again, it's more or less just fighting about the root that this evolutionary process
took. Yeah, where something branched off from the main trunk.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas I would say there's an even, if you actually look at everything that has been found and discovered over the years, there's a much bigger problem.
And doesn't evolution, the whole theory of evolution, present the foundation of a lot of this problem? Because evolution dictates that one species turns into another and they're all related and all of this.
Yes, so therefore you have to see things like that.
Yeah.
Everyone is required to see things like that. And if you don't see things like that, then... it's very, very difficult to play the game.
Well, I guess another problem would be philosophically that, so evolution happens, it's one of the processes, I think it's just one of many forces that cause change and diversity, but if you can trace back human ants, 7 million, 70 million, 700 million or whatever, they could still say, well, evolution has been changing and evolving the species. And you look at Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal, they were different from us and all that. So you've got that at work. But no matter how far you trace stuff back, then why don't you see more evidence for the hallmarks of being human, which is hallmarks of civilization, tools, artifacts, and all of that. Actually, that really defines us as being human. And so they would argue, we just don't see that going back way, way back. But maybe they haven't read your book.
Well, I would say they haven't, because you do get fragmentary but intriguing signs of cultural evidence. It's not just the bones that you find going back in distant times. You find You find examples such as gold chains, metal pots,
writing on walls.
Yes, things like that. So there are signs of
development. And it's on strata that's way, 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 way old.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a beautiful metallic vase with engraved floral patterns on it was discovered in layers of rock over 600 million years old. That's from a report in Scientific American from the year 1852.
And it was well documented to be just something that fell down a crevasse into some ancient strata, but was actually, or the piece of old coal from a real ancient strata broke it open. That's where one of those gold chains was found. I mean, it's extraordinary stuff.
Well, it is. And to me, what's really striking is that there's a continuous chain of these discoveries going back from, the most recent times to millions and millions and millions of years ago. In other words, we're not talking about a few isolated discoveries here and there, but we're talking about a fairly continuous chain of well-documented discoveries from the scientific literature of the past century or so, documenting these finds. And it is that type of evidence which makes me conclude that all of the fuss about some fragmentary bones of a very gorilla-like or chimpanzee-like creature being the father or mother of us all, it really makes me begin to wonder about that.
So the knowledge filter still in effect here.
Yes.
Let's take anything away from chimpanzees and gorillas and all the other animals. It's high time that we understood how intelligent and compassionate and marvelous creatures they all are.
Oh, absolutely.
Thinking we're just at the top of the heap and oh so special.
No, they actually are quite interesting creatures and, as you say, intelligent as well.
Yeah. So what's the solution here?
Well, I think it's an educational process, and you're helping with it, and I'm grateful for it, that people just have to know all of the facts. And the problem is, when most people go to school, they get a textbook on biology or human history or anthropology or archaeology, and they look and they see, here's a certain number of facts that are reported, and here's their picture of human origins, and the facts appear to go along with the ideas that they're stating, so the ideas must be true. But the problem is, most people are not, they're simply not getting all the facts. I mean, if they were getting all the facts, if they did know about all of the discoveries that have been made, and not just those that they see in their textbooks, they'd realize there's something else going on. They would find that if they looked at all the facts, the picture that we get is one of coexistence of human beings and apes and monkeys and various types of ape men, and not one of evolution.
And it's interesting, too, that when we look at a lot of the ancient mythology, it's saying the same thing, that human culture, you can trace it far, far, far back into the distant past.
Oh, and practically so, every culture in the world has said that, except ours today.
High time that we give more credit and credence to our ancestors and their picture of our history. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Michael will tell us a bit about another controversy going on, is tracing out our more recent roots, looking at the Indo-European languages and that cultural history. So more with Michael Cremo when we come back. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.
All interviews on The Laura Lee Show are available on audio cassette. For information, call 1-800-243-1438.
The Laura Lee Show is brought to you by the following sponsors. Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend. Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend contains 50 phytonutrient-rich whole foods, whole food concentrates, vegetables, herbs, providing protein, essential fats, minerals, vitamins, and fiber, along with enzymes for ready digestibility. Add to vegetable juice, oatmeal, porridge, yogurt, applesauce, or soups, and can be sprinkled on virtually any food. Call 1-800-243-1438 for a special offer on Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend. Or for links for more information, go to radiobookstore.com.
Hard to believe that an herb has the power to kill bacteria, viruses, and other pathogens, but the wild oregano growing in the Mediterranean does just that, and as effectively as prescription drugs. Numerous laboratory experiments demonstrate this power, yet oregano is safe and gentle on the body. North American Herb and Spice produces the finest, the purest, the most potent line of oregano products, Oregamax, Oregasin, and Super Strength Oil of Oregano. Read about the numerous lab studies, how to use oregano, and what it can do to protect your health against a wide range of common pathogens and parasites. It's all at oregamax.com. You can also call them direct at 800-243-5242 to place an order or find a store nearest you for your oregano products. A wild oregano, the most potent herb ever tested, yet gentle and safe. It's a great and wonderful gift of nature, and you can call 800-243-5242 and visit oregamax.com. Did you know enzymes are needed for each and every of the millions of biochemical reactions in our body? Past the age of 30, our body's natural production of enzymes slows down. That's why we need to supplement. I take Vitalzyme. It's the most complete and effective blend of enzymes with protease, serrapeptase, papain, bromelain, amylase, lipase, rutin, and amla. What do these enzymes do? They help so many vital functions. To balance our body's own repair mechanisms, regulate the formation of fibrin, cleanse the blood of debris, promote good blood circulation, maintain immune system health, and much, much more. Vitalzyme contains no animal derivatives, no artificial flavors or colors, and no talc, lactose, yeast, or gluten. For your supply of Vitalzyme and a free cassette of Dr. Will Wong's Systemic Enzyme Therapy, call World Nutrition at 800-548-2710. That's 800-548-2710. Let's get back to our conversation with Michael Cremo, co-author of Forbidden Archaeology and The Hidden History of the Human Race, both available at the Radio Bookstore. Michael, you've long been a Vedic scholar, and you were interested in demonstrating that what the Vedas say about their own history, about human culture, about human evolution, is true. That's your agenda. And tell us a little bit what your attraction to the Vedic culture is, why you spent your life work defending it, and then also of this other recent controversy. I find it quite intriguing. Again, I'm interested in where does evidence lead us and what are the alternative pictures. You're saying the whole argument of European culture and Vedic culture being tied because of the common parts of language, Sanskrit to European languages, and is an intriguing one. There's a controversy heating up as to who came first. Could you give us some background first?
Well, my interest then in Vedic culture, I mean, I would have to probably trace it back to some past life. Of course, I believe in reincarnation, and I think I must have had some contact with it in some previous life. But in this life, the way it manifested for me was, well, for one thing, I was raised in a military family, and that meant living in various parts of the world, which I think opened my mind quite a bit to, you know, different cultures. Maybe if I spent my entire life in my, you know, the town I was born in the United States, maybe I wouldn't be so interested in such things. That's a possibility. But given that during my whole life I was exposed to many different cultures and many different ways of life in various parts of the world, I did become interested in such things. And I think my first interest in going to India was awakened when I was on a vacation in Europe. I was living in Germany at the time. I was 16 years old, and a friend of mine and I, during Easter vacation, we hitchhiked from Germany to Sweden, and we were staying in youth hostels. And I met some kids of my own age, or maybe a little bit older, who had gone overland from Europe to India and back. And they were just telling me some fascinating stories about their experiences, and I decided I wanted to go there. So I filed that away in my memory bank, and I began to read things about India and Indian philosophy as I was growing up and entering into the university. I read the Bhagavad Gita, for example, and the Upanishads, and other literatures like that, and novels that had to do with voyages to India and things like that, the writings of Marco Polo. And finally, when I was a little bit older, I determined that I wanted to go. And eventually I did go to India. I've been there over 10 times now. And about 30 years ago, I became acquainted with one of the spiritual masters or gurus from India, and his name was Bhaktivedanta Swami. He was, for some time, a person that George Harrison, one of the Beatles, was approaching for knowledge, and I became very interested in his teachings and eventually became an initiated disciple and began a formal study of the Vedic literature. And I was particularly interested in the Puranas, or the histories. And that's how I got interested in this whole question of the the relationship between the ancient culture and language of India and the other languages. This is, historically what happened is that in the 17th and 18th century, during the time that the various European powers like the Netherlands and Portugal and England and France were establishing their dominance in India. Eventually the British, the English, pretty much took over all of India and made it part of their empire. During that time, not only the soldiers and the politicians and the tradespeople were going out there, but scholars were going to India as well. And they noticed a connection between the ancient Sanskrit language of India and the European languages.
What sort of connection? Because on the face of it, they seem very different.
Well, if you look at the vocabulary, for example, the Sanskrit word for mother is mat, and it's very close to the Russian word, which is the same, mat, and the English word mother, and the German word Mutter. And they're all connected. You can look at the words for father and brother and sister and son, and there are just hundreds of words. If you look at
that, looks like they have a common root.
Yeah, they have a common. They have some common connection. Now it appeared to these scholars that Sanskrit was the oldest language. It was older linguistically than the other ones, the European languages. So that suggested something, namely that these other languages had come from Sanskrit, and because we generally identify people with language, that would mean that the European peoples and languages had their origins in the Indian subcontinent. Now, that was an idea that most European scholars were not prepared to accept at all. And the way that they got around it was, is they suggested, well, two things. One was, yes, Sanskrit was the original language, and all the other languages came from Sanskrit, but Sanskrit originally existed in Europe, not India. And then it only later went into India in what they called an Indo-European migration, or sometimes they use the word Aryan, because Aryan is a Sanskrit word that means cultured. Now, of course, during the 1930s, it got picked up, that word got picked up by the Germans, by the Nazis, and it got turned into a racial term, meaning blue-eyed, blonde-haired, Nordic people who are supposed to rule the entire world, which is not the original meaning of the word at all. So sometimes they call this the Indo-European migration or the Aryan migration, but the basic idea was that Sanskrit and the culture associated with it, which are now identified with India, did not originally exist there. They existed in some other part of the world.
A question about migrations. I understand when one people migrate, but they're meeting other people. They're interacting with people along the way. Migrations take hundreds and thousands of years. People don't just pick up and make a straight beeline, you know, across half a continent. They stay and they settle and they push forward and they're meeting people who are already there because there's already indigenous societies, layers and layers and layers of them wherever you go. And so it's not just a one-way stream. You know, you don't just pick up from India and just have a one-way flow to Europe. I would imagine that it's just a whole lot of intersecting of tributaries. So how can they even suggest that, you know?
Well, the idea that, this is what the debate is all about.
Yeah.
There would be one side that would say, okay, the Sanskrit-speaking peoples, they originated outside of India. And then languages and peoples diversified from them and spread all over Europe and the Middle East. And then a group of these people went into India. Now, that would mean that the Indo-European homeland, you might say, would be in Europe, which would really that really suited the purposes of the people at that time.
So your argument is that they are so Eurocentric that they want to twist the evidence around to suggest that they're one of the primary origins of culture today, as opposed to just following where the evidence goes.
Yes, and this was particularly true in the 19th century when the Europeans were ruling India, and that really suited their political purposes to say that.
Therefore, it gives us the right to go and rule India and.
Yes, because actually you're just our old European brothers and you've forgotten your European culture and now we've come to remind you of it.
Right.
We had to bring you back up to the European standard. You left Europe, you came down here to India and kind of lost.
Well, we claim you and re-educate you and put you back in your place. You
know. That was the idea. Now, of course, those of us who are students of the Vedic culture would we would see that the Vedic culture was always present in India.
And what did the Puranas say about that?
Well,
exactly?
It's very interesting because if you look in the Vedic literature, you look in the Puranas, there's no mention at all of coming from some other place. And the Vedic literatures, like the Rig Veda, for example, according to modern scholarship, they were composed supposedly within a couple of hundred years, within 300 years after this migration into India took place. So it's really extraordinary. I mean,
that they wouldn't mention we came from somewhere else if that were the case. You're saying.
Just like, for example, we're Americans and we're living here in North America, and we know that we're of European. I mean, most of us are of European heritage. There's some African heritage, but
and some native heritage, let's not forget that.
Some natives, they were here too. And, of course, they don't believe they came from anywhere. They believe they were always here. But that's another story. But we know that 500 years ago, or even more, according to some people, that Europeans came here from somewhere else. It's part of our history. We celebrate it.
So you're saying the equivalent would be that the writing of the Rig Veda and other texts would be such that they would have forgotten their origins if they had just recently migrated into the India subcontinent.
Right. They would have had to have completely forgotten it, which is that we don't forget.
Why should they?
I mean, we understand what happened 300 or 400 years ago, that there was a big migration of European. See, then another point is, if you look at the place names in northern India, Now, the idea of these Aryan migration theorists is that there was another people living in India,
the
non-Vedic people, the Dravidian people. And then there was this invasion of Sanskrit-speaking people, about 1500 B.C., they would say. And now, if that were true, then we should expect to see in northern India a lot of Dravidian place names, just like North America. There were the Native American peoples were living here.
And many of our states and our mountains and our cities
and
all have names that are taken from the Native original names.
The Mississippi River, the state of Connecticut, the state of Massachusetts. Names of places like rivers and mountains and streams are very conservative.
Mm-hmm. Change slowly, in other words.
They change slowly. So you would just as we see here in North America, there are literally thousands of places, of thousands of rivers and streams and valleys and mountains and other geographical places that have retained their Indian names. But we don't see anything like that. And
You
don't see any Dravidian.
You see Sanskrit names.
All Sanskrit names.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you have some problems there for those who want to support, you know, this idea that the culture came in from outside.
We have to have more support from scientific evidence and from the academic arena than just saying, oh, we don't want to believe that we came from there, that we rather infiltrated there and were the origin. You have to have more support than that. Or did you in the 19th century when things were pretty sketchy or 18th century?
Well,
I
think neither side really has a lot of evidence to support what they're saying at this point.
That's my point. How can you...
of course, there are the points that I mentioned. No mention of any migration in the ancient writings of the culture. No pre-Sanskrit names. Now, there is some potential for, I think, the question to be settled.
Because there's a new find archaeologically.
Yes, and it may lie in the Indus Valley, because there, in the early 1920s, British researchers uncovered two cities, Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, in the Indus Valley.
Those are fascinating places, aren't they?
And
advanced for their time.
And they are, they date back to right about, you know, the essential time period. They would be about 4,000 to 5,000 years old, which means they would predate the supposed time that the Aryan migration into India took place, if it did take place. So both parties are very interested in this, it's now called the Harappan civilization or the Indus Valley civilization. In addition to the two sites of Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, about 800 to 1,000 additional sites have now been discovered in this region. And the amazing thing is that the culture has not yet been identified. And the reason is that the language of the inscriptions these people have left has not been deciphered yet. The scripts are found on what are called seals. They're small, rectangular, or round pieces of stone in which there are carvings of pictures of animals or plants or mythological scenes, but also symbols, which appear to be letters or numbers in an alphabet. Or maybe not an alphabet, that might not be the proper word for it, but these things were used to stamp clay. They may have been used in trade or for some political purpose. But that's the only writing that they have from this civilization. And a lot hinges upon how it's deciphered. It's one of the big mysteries in archaeology, and it may be solved in the future in a couple of different ways, but there, up to the present moment, there have been dozens of attempts to decipher this script, and the two basic approaches have been to look at it as either a Sanskrit-type script which I would very much favor, and the other is meant to look at it as perhaps a Dravidian script. And nobody has been able to offer a convincing decipherment yet.
One way or the other.
And
how many skulls, how many stone seals have been
found? As I said, the script is found on these stone seals, and there are several hundred of them. There are many hundreds of them. And when linguists look at them, they see that the symbols on them, there are about 400 different symbols. Now, that gives them some clues as to what type of script it was or what type of language it was.
Or how it was used and how it was structured.
Right.
Does it have any relationship to the pictures of the animals and the plants, do you suppose? Do they correlate at all?
Well, one would think that there is some kind of correlation there, but it's hard to tell exactly what it would be. Now, like our alphabet has has 26 letters in it. So alphabets, where you have letters
that combine to make words.
Sound. Mm. Generally, alphabets have between 26 and 40 characters. So some people will say, if this script has 400 different characters in it, then it couldn't be a strict alphabetic script.
More of a pictorial, like the Chinese system?
But even then, they say it's not enough for a strictly pictorial system, like the Egyptian or the Chinese, because there they have thousands of different symbols.
And these are only 400 different symbols.
So some have suggested it may be something like they have an alphabet, but they use different little symbols to change the pronunciation of the words. And actually modern Sanskrit is like this. They have an alphabet of about 40 characters, but they combine them. If you look in the Sanskrit literature, they combine these characters in different ways, and they put little signs over them. Like if they have a G, if they put a little sign over it, it means God. If they put another sign over it, it means gay. If they put another sign over it, it means goo.
But somebody who doesn't know Sanskrit could look at that and assume that those are three different modifications of one character. So that's
right.
How you could come up to a count of like 400.
Several hundred. So
this would support it being like Sanskrit or a proto pre-Sanskrit because it's structured in a similar way, you're saying?
Yes, like that. There's a Subhash Kak, a computer scientist at Louisiana State University, who's done an analysis of the Indus Valley, the characters in the Indus Valley script, and he's compared them to a later alphabet in India that's called Brahmi. That is, it's accepted to be a Sanskrit alphabet. It's been deciphered. Everyone accepts that it's an alphabet used to encode Sanskrit literature.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done a very interesting study where he's looked at the frequency of the letters in the Brahmi script. Just like in English, we know that S and E are very common letters in English, and Z and X aren't very common. So he's taken the most common letters in the most common characters in the Indus script, and he's compared them to the most common characters in this Brahmi script, which is a Sanskrit script, and he's found that they matched.
Oh, wow.
They matched, which is, it doesn't prove. I mean, he hasn't offered any decipherments of the Indus Valley script, but he said that's pretty suggestive, you know, that the most common characters in the Indus Valley script match up with the most common characters in this Brahmi script, which is a form of Sanskrit. So that was a very interesting observation. But,
what about a common mother tongue? You know, they say you go way back, and I think Atlantis is a code word for this common mother culture. This Indus Valley script might be just one step further back to a common language, and couldn't we explain that's why there's so many an underlayment of commonality between something as diverse as the European languages and the Hindu language, Sanskrit?
Yes.
And here or there, maybe all of it comes from, you know, if you go back layer after layer after layer, you're finding more and more. And this may be what the whole Tower of Babel is about. Maybe there was.
This is one solution I was going to mention that
we're almost out of time.
Scientists have said about the Indo-European languages, at least. Those would be the European languages and Sanskrit and Iranian and like that. They say that there must have been some language that existed before all of them that was the source of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they've even reconstructed this language based on some linguistic principles, but the problem with it is that nobody has ever discovered a single text of it. It simply exists in the minds of the linguistics people.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's certainly a possibility, but as far as the oldest
when you can get your hands on
text that you have, it doesn't exist.
So, well, good luck, Michael.
Well, thank you, Morley.
And thank you for this report, and I hope you keep us posted on any further developments.
I'd be happy to do that.
We have a link to Michael's website and his book, Forbidden Archaeology, co-authored with Richard Thompson.